Welcome to History 101, Europe and the World. First Lecture, Introduction. This is a standard History 101 module, World History or Europe and the World, as it is taught in many universities. Now, dear listener, let me tell you first what this course is not. It is not two things. First, when making this course, it struck me that many other people teaching it apparently view it as either of two things, and often both. First, this is not a standard Western civilization course, with then some non-West thrown in for good measure, as appears to be the standard format for these kind of courses. Let me tell you what the reason is. The World History course was, in my view, developed in the 70s and 80s in the United States in the context of what in the United States were then called the culture wars. That is, to limit this only to university contests, as more and more people, of particular Asian migrants, under the US policy of positive discrimination, went to university, these students were being taught the standard Western civilization courses. And they could feel they were given short thrift in history education that was almost exclusively focused on dead, white, male Anglo-Saxons. This, obviously, was particularly galling for Asian students. For while African Americans had been saying for ages that Western civilization courses were merely Western dominance and white supremacy courses in disguise, when you had in the 1970s the rise of and the call for so-called Afrocentric history, which, to parody it a bit, is really Western civilization, but put upside down, in its extreme form, claiming that all that founded Western civilization was stolen by those very same dead white Anglo-Saxon males from Africa, and from Black Egypt in particular. Western civilization, however, could conveniently cold shoulder or ignore Africa and Africans. After all, it could be said, Africans have no written history. Yet nobody in his right mind would claim that China or Japan had no history or civilization. The tendency since the 70s, more or less evolving from the bottom up, was therefore to allot some space in the standard Western civilization course for China and Japan, and not to have their history begin, as is still the tendency in many manuals on the moment, not to have their history begin on the moment they got in contact with the West, a very problematic Cold War word that they would rather like to avoid. The tendency in the standard World History course appears to be to simply do the standard Western Civilization course, always grouped under such broad catch-all terms as the Reformation, the rise of absolutism, the Industrial Revolution, the World Wars, the Cold War, and what have you, and then allot one or two sessions to East Asia or to Africa that are otherwise not integrated in the narrative at all. Or East Asian and African histories are subsumed within a, to use a difficult and ponderous word, hegemonic narrative. A hegemonic narrative that is entirely focused on Europe. What is called for, in the long run, is what historian Deepesh Chakrabarty calls provincializing Europe. A realization that European history is but part, and in the very long run, perhaps not even that important a part, of the history of mankind. The problem on the moment, however, is that historians, myself included, do not have a clue how to get away from a Europe-centered narrative that they have, after all, been using for ages. And frankly, Chakrabarty doesn't greatly contribute to solving that question either. Most historians, after all, have been taught history only in the European tradition, and that European tradition has never ceased loudly praising both itself and Europe. What is called for, I think, is to use yet another ponderous word, decentralizing history. Getting rid of a grand narrative entirely derived from Europe and from class societies. The rise of absolutism, the Industrial Revolution, and so forth. Second, and that is as urgent, if not more so, history has to be, to use yet another ponderous term, freed of the nation. What this means in this course is that I will not conceive this course, as is the case with most other courses, as a course in the history of all countries, but not my own. This tendency is particularly marked amongst US historians. Dutch ones, by contrast, like to teach courses on Dutch history in a European context, where, to only mock them a bit, this in a European context is but another way of saying our country is better than other European countries. It would, however, never occur to them to conceive themselves as sitting on some distant planet, where what occurs elsewhere has nothing to do with and has no relationship whatsoever to what's happening in the USA. Obviously, this is an almost obvious way of thinking in the USA, a continental landmass separated by oceans from the bad, old rest of the world. That's a luxury Dutch historians, a small country surrounded by bigger countries that have repeatedly occupied it, are not allowed. Yet by contrast, two other countries, even more isolated than the USA, Australia and New Zealand, tended to think of themselves up to a very short time ago as offshoots of British civilization. Australian and New Zealand history were, as it were, provincial branches of British history, just like, for example, that of Scotland would be. And it is only very recently that Australian and New Zealand historians have begun to think of themselves as having a completely different history to that of Britain. What all this boils down to is that most History 101 courses, as they are taught in the USA, are courses on what is taking place in Europe, in Asia and Africa. All that has no relationship with what's happening in the USA whatsoever. And what's happening in the USA is entirely dependent on internal developments within the USA, and those have nothing to do with the rest of the world whatsoever. The USA, after all, is better than other countries. We are even to say they might have been influenced by things outside of the USA, you will likely be accused of unpatriotic. It is because American historians are so afraid of being accused of being not patriotic enough that they are extremely reluctant to bring in the USA in the world history courses. They are not alone in that. There is a somewhat similar tendency amongst British historians, who too tend to have an extremely insular vision of their own history. It used to be called the Whig vision of history. Basically, in that vision, the continent, going all the way back to the Norman conquests, if not to the times of the Anglo-Saxons, did everything wrong, and the British did everything right. Whether that be industrial society, rule by law, possessive individualism, parliamentary rule, habeas corpus, what else have you? Such good things were always completely invented by the British on their own, and the British always did everything right and the continent always went in the wrong direction. It is obviously a form of British nationalism, as is the American feeling that they have evolved completely perfect institutions on their own separate continent in utter isolation from the rest of the world. There are, frankly, few countries where nationalism is that all-pervasive and extreme as in the US and in Britain, unlike the other three major English-speaking countries, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, all still struggling with their identity. Except that in the USA and in Britain, they have a different name. Nationalism is something bad, unhealthy. It is something people on the Balkans do. The Americans and British have patriotism, and patriotism is a good thing. Now there are broadly, on the moment, three different ways of doing world history. I would call them big history, international history, and world history, also called global history, particularly if you're talking about the 20th century. I should immediately emphasize, I sympathize most with world history. However, world history, and to my credit, appears to increasingly lose out to international history, in funding as much as on the job market. Of these three, big history, of which the best known representatives are the Australian historian David Christian and the American biologist Jared Diamond, is on the one hand what French historian Emmanuel Roy-Ladurie once dubbed history without human beings, and on the other, an often somewhat overly enthusiastic attempt to apply insights from another branch of learning to history. Such enthusiasm is by itself nothing new. In my youth, back in the 70s, there was a lot of excitement in applying what were to historians then new insights from theoretic economics to history. Theoretic economics would provide the final clue to the historic process. Traditional history, as the newcomers always call it, was denied. It was then generally thought that if you wanted to be a serious historian, you had to do serial history. Serious history, thus, was manually putting data on punch cards. That marvelous machine, just invented, the computer, back then the size of an office block, might then process for you, and that would provide the final clue to history. And for somebody trained in dialectical materialism, or Marxism, as the Americans call it, the fine art was then always to show how anything, whether it be the style of Gothic cathedrals or Shakespeare's poetry, could ultimately be traced back to the relations of production. Now, big history similarly seeks to apply insights from another branch of learning, in this case physics, biology and ecology, to history. We have two ways of doing big history. One extremely useful, the other I feel of doubtful utility. To start with the not so useful one, it is to apply concepts from biology or physics, such as complexity, to human history. Thus, for example, big historians might argue that humans tend to cluster in complex structures. They call them civilization. Much as, or they might argue, and here's when I begin to get serious doubt, because all living organisms tend to cluster in complex structures as well. Humans behave just like spores, and their history can thus be explained in a very similar way. Now I feel that in the much as form, this is at best a metaphor. Humans are simply not cells, and furthermore, and here's why this entire metaphor falls flat, humans have a consciousness of themselves, and cells clearly have not. At worst, in the because form, this is a philosophy, or as you like it, a theology of history that dons itself as objective science. But whereas Hegel, or St. Augustine, at least made clear theirs was a philosophy of history, big history tends to shy away from all that. It tends to stress it is merely summing up scientific facts. The more useful branch of big history is history with the humans left out. In the USA, this is particularly linked to historian Arthur Cosby, and in Europe, to the already mentioned Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie. Leroy Ladurie perhaps best illustrated it with the anecdote that if he were offered the, of course, purely hypothetic choice between interviewing Napoleon and his horse, he would go for his horse, because, after all, the horse has a disputed and highly contentious history of domestication. And while we know a great deal about what humans think about the horse, we know absolutely nothing of what the horse thinks about humans. Now, this kind of big history has made a very major contribution to history over the past 40 years. And it has forced historians to entirely rethink their craft in many ways. Thus, for example, the history of the early modern period can only be adequately understood if we always remember that in Europe, China, and most importantly in the Central Asian steppes, this was a period of extreme cold. Temperatures were 3 or 4 degrees below average of temperatures nowadays. This period is called the Little Ice Age, a term originally devised by geologists studying glaciers. Historians were entirely unaware of that 40 years ago. It will, of course, not answer the question of, for example, why Philip II of Spain voted his son Don Juan. But it has a very major impact when you study agricultural cropping patterns in northern Spain, or the migration of Spanish sheep. It is very likely Spain was getting drier in the 16th century, and this in turn firstly hit Spain's main export, wool. It may, in this way, even have contributed to the quarrel of Philip II with his son. Now, obviously, climate patterns are linked to wind and ocean movements, movements that affect the entire world. And the Little Ice Age, it has plausibly been argued, may even have been related to the temperature of the sun. Humans had very little to do with that, though it deeply affected them. Big history in this way has made a very important contribution to history. Yet I would advise caution with the claims of its more extreme proponents, such as Jared Diamond, that big history explains all of history. Thus, for example, Diamond wrote a book called Collapse, in which he argued that due to innate cultural patterns, humans, blinded by their culture, may willingly demolish their own ecosystem, thus causing their society to collapse in the very long run. Diamond proved his case by a couple of examples: the obscure island of Henderson in the Pacific, the Anasazi of the southwestern United States, and the Mayas. Now, as long as Diamond stuck to Henderson and to the Anasazi, the historians had very little choice but to not. Maybe so, for we know little about the Anasazi, and even less about Henderson. Yet as soon as he touched on the Mayas, the Maya specialists immediately violently disagreed with him. For we do know a great deal about the Mayas, and the Maya civilization, those specialists would say, never collapsed, disappeared. It is pretty much still there. After all, at least 7 million people still have Maya as their main tongue, and they have a Maya culture under a very thin Spanish veneer. The second branch of world history, international history, has a completely different pedigree than big history. Unlike big history, That is very, very young. International history is very, very old. Indeed, it may be traced back all the way to the Greek-Roman historian Polybius, who lived from 203 to 220 before Common Era, or BC. For diplomatic and military history is what historians have always been primarily concerned with, and it is the thing they are best at since Polybius too. Now, I would not hesitate to call Polybius the first international historian, for unlike previous Greek historians, Polybius explicitly set out to write a history of all the inhabited world, as he called it. A good example of the extreme ethnocentrism of the Greeks, by the way, because the inhabited world meant for Polybius the Mediterranean. And Polybius, in my view, also made the most convincing plea for world history ever, when he argued that much as you cannot reconstruct an animal from merely looking at its parts, so too, you cannot reconstruct history by merely studying fragments of it. Now, following in the footsteps of Polybius, international history at least started off as a branch of the old-fashioned diplomatic history in the 70s. It did not want to study the diplomacy of individual countries, as rather the entire system of diplomatic relations of which individual countries were but a part. Much as Polybius tried to reconstruct the rise of the Roman Empire by considering circumstances in Greece, in Carthaginian North Africa, amongst the Celtiberian tribes of the Iberian Peninsula, or even took a look at Gaul. Similarly, an international historian might, for example, explain British policy towards the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, not by either events in Britain or in the Ottoman Empire, but by the British need to keep the Ottoman Empire intact as a buffer between aggressive and unreliable Russia and British India. That logic derived from the entire system, rather than from two countries. Or, to make this clear with a yet more recent example, an international historian might explain the invasion of Iraq as caused neither by George W. Bush's particular aversion towards Saddam Hussein, which he obviously accused of having tried to kill his father, nor by the certainty of the Pentagon that the Iraqi military might be a pushover, but rather by a very global US policy. And that again followed from the logic of the entire system. And that runs as follows. As China would conceivably grow to be a superpower that would potentially rival the USA, it would conceivably need ever more resources. Resources it could not supply itself. The best way of containing China was therefore for the USA to obtain control over all these resources, and particularly over the one country which had still large and little exploited reserves of oil, namely Iraq. As the international diplomatic system has, as this example might serve to show, many links with the global economic system, international historians also seek to investigate economic ties between countries and international arrangements, agreements or laws which enable such ties. International historians might, for example, be interested in the history of international arrangements on the transmission of mail, so that all countries nowadays recognize a market post stamp. They might also be interested in international arrangements on the transmission of electricity from one country to another, so that there are nowadays only two systems of sockets that are internationally used, one on the European continent, the other of countries of the former British Empire, and not 185 sockets for 184 countries. This is often not altogether the most exciting kind of research, Much of this kind of research, for a reader particular, is boring. But that it is a valid branch of research, I would not deny. International history is on this moment the most rapidly growing branch of world history. And that has an obvious reason. Historians tend typically to rely on written sources and negotiations on the standards of the electric sockets used between different countries tend to generate masses of correspondence, because there's no particular hurry in them, and these kind of negotiations thus tend to be slow and long-winding. There is, however, also a major and obvious weakness to international history. It is almost entirely applicable only to the 19th and 20th century, and particularly to the period after the rise of modern imperialism, that for the first time, as we shall see in a later lecture, created an interlocked, worldwide, diplomatic and economic system. If I were, for example, to study the foreign and even the economic policy of the modern Republic of Ghana, in fact, even much of its internal policy, I could explain that by looking to Ghana's relationships with major economic blocs, such as the European Union. I might study the policy of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank towards Ghana, and so on and so forth. A standard case of international history, and it works just fine. If I were to study the policy of the distant ancestor of modern Ghana, the 16th century kingdom of Denkirie, centered in the north of modern Ghana, I might explain it by looking to the wider system of alliances between the Savannah kingdoms of West Africa, of which Denkirie was undeniably a part. But though the Portuguese were then already on the coast of modern Ghana, and the Portuguese arguably ring Denkirie to a wider Atlantic or world system, you will find there were very few real connections. And that these were certainly too few in number to explain the internal policy of Denkirie. In other words, international history works very well for the 20th century. It gets increasingly difficult the further you regress back in time, unless that is, as is the common view amongst most international historians, you want to explain global history in terms of the expansion of the so-called Westphalian system of sovereign states across the world. Now, to confine oneself only to this Westphalian system is, in my view, an unnecessarily restrictive and Eurocentric way of looking at things. Consider the following example. One of the most famous texts in all of world history, almost always studied in all world history classes, are the travels of Ibn Battuta, who lived from 1304 to 1369. Now, what is so interesting about Ibn Battuta is his profession. Ibn Battuta was namely a lawyer. And if there is one profession which is nowadays very difficult to transplant from one country to another, it is that of a lawyer. After all, the Netherlands or Ghana have completely different laws on inheritance or divorce than has the USA. Ibn Battuta, on the other hand, could seek for employment anywhere he went, whether it be in Kilwa, East Africa, Timbuktu, or in Zaitun in China, as, wherever he went, Muslim communities used the very same Islamic Sharia. And Ibn Battuta might even in places he considered completely out of the way hellholes, such as the Maldives, where he was marooned for a while, still advise the local judges on how matters are done with us in Cairo. Politically, the world Ibn Battuta marched through was extremely fragmented. It consisted of tiny kingdoms, constantly fighting one another. Yet legally, it was a unified system. By contrast, the present political units are generally much bigger than in Ibn Battuta's time, and they form part of an interlocking diplomatic system. So that, for example, present Mali has a Chinese ambassador, whereas in Ibn Battuta's time there were no contacts between Mali and China whatsoever. Legally, however, the international system has fragmented. In Ibn Battuta's time, there was a system, but it was an entirely different system than the diplomatic or even the economic system the international historians commonly depart from. It is therefore critical to bring a comparative approach to global history. Which brings me to the third branch of world history, and that has two approaches, the comparative and the connective, or linked. Like international history, comparative history has a very long pedigree. If we do not want to go all the way back to Herodotus, it can at least be traced back to the age of the discoveries. The first truly comparative history might be a book of the Neapolitan humanist Giovanni Botero from 1590, titled Relazione Universale, as it sought to unify a geographic description of the entire world with an outline of the economic activities of all the places in the world, of their customs, and with a brief outline of their history. To that respect, this was the first truly world historic work. This world historic tradition was then pursued by great Dutch humanists such as Over Dapper, who wrote descriptions of practically all places in the world in the 17th century, and that in turn was used and improved upon by the first truly great work of scientific comparative history, namely Johann Gottfried von Herder's idea on the philosophical history of humanity, which was published in 1783. Now, in the 18th century, the word philosophical often stood for what nowadays would rather be called sociology. It might even be called economics. And in its broadest sense, Herder's idea on the philosophical history of humanity were a sociological tract. He elaborated on the influence of what was then called the climate, and would now rather be called the ecology, on human institutions. Herder broadly argued that human institutions are a product of the local ecology, and that, and here Herder was truly far ahead of his time, as European institutions reflect a European ecology, which in turn influences European character, European institutions were by no means appropriate for the whole world. To voice it in modern terms, and this almost takes one back to big history, humans evolve such institutions as allow them to best cope with their environment and with their ecology. This was what we might now call a sociological thesis. And ever since the age of Auguste Comte, generally seen as the founder of sociology, or at least the word sociology is his, in the beginning of the 19th century, since, as said, much of what was in the 18th century called philosophy was in fact sociology, comparative history has become the special domain of sociology, or, rather, given the fragmentation of the field in the 20th century, of a special branch of sociology, namely historical sociology. The greatest practitioner of historical sociology was no doubt the great Max Weber, on whom I shall have a lot more to say later. Now, in some ways, modern sociologists, while still, of course, paying lip service to Max Weber, who after all, together with Emile Durkheim and much more difficult Karl Marx, is rated as one of the trinity of founding fathers of sociology, sociologists have in fact be moving ever further away from historical sociology. Because since the 30s, sociology has ever been more influenced by what might broadly be called behaviorism. The view that social scientists should study observable phenomena that can be experimentally repeated and preferably should be expressed in figures and in mathematical forms. Therefore, they have increasingly come to shun historical analyses. History is clearly not amenable for repeating in a laboratory environment, and you cannot handle questionnaires to people who are already long dead. I would like to say, therefore, comparative historians could learn a lot from sociology. But actually, as sociology has become completely absorbed in the present, or in the very near past, when the people you can hand questionnaires are not yet dead, it is far less useful than I would like it to be. And in particular, I should warn against the tendency of sociologists, since they tend to be so much fixed on the very near past, that we are witnessing what they always call unprecedented change in the present. In fact, the kind of standard sociological models students of social sciences are typically taught in their very first year of study, which tend to focus on a deep distinction between traditional societies, considered to be stable, if not stagnant, and dynamic modernity, are entirely built around that idea that we are witnessing unprecedented change. The problem is that any society always has the idea it is going through unprecedented change. Had you asked somebody in such a, to sociologist, very traditional society as that of 15th century Italy, what he thought about the present, he would surely have told you he was living in modernity as against the Gothic Middle Ages, both terms of abuse back then. These Middle Ages surely were stagnant, but he was experiencing unprecedented change. And in his day and time, every social relation that was once fixed is melting into thin air, as Ford Madox in turn voiced his experience of the period around 1907, another time of unprecedented change. It is therefore extremely risky to build one's view on a teleology of the path to modernity. Since first, what is modern today is, of course, old tomorrow. This may seem a platitude, but it also implies that much what may seem very important today may not appear to have been so in retrospect, as I will argue about the Cold War and the War on Terror later on. And furthermore, it tends to ignore too many possible paths to modernity that were, more or less by coincidence, not taken, and that might have led to a completely different outcome, a very different modernity. Now, if this implies an implicit criticism of historical sociology, and it is, let me nevertheless say that a few people have remained, they have not given up on historical sociology, and they have made important contributions. But I would particularly like to single out the British sociologist Stephen Runciman and Michael Mann. In particular to the latter, I have quite a debt. Now, what is comparative history, or for that matter, comparative historical sociology? Basically, it means that you bring out the precise characteristic of some historical phenomenon by comparing it to another, which it somewhat resembles in outline, but not quite, where you highlight some general characteristics they share with one another to then better bring out what they don't share. you're basically not interested so much in the comparandum, but rather in the phenomenon you're dealing with on the moment. Historians do this all of the time. It is the true bread and butter of the profession. So much so, that to that extent indeed, all history is world history. And all historians are writing world history. However, in the comparative method, you do not, and this is a very major not, argue that things may resemble one another because they are linked, or may have the same cause. What you rather argue is that they may resemble one another to bring out typical characteristics of one of them. For example, if you are studying medieval feudalism in the 10th century common era, you may argue it has some resemblances to Hittite society in the 10th century before the common era. Both, after all, were societies centered on horse warriors, whether they were driving a chariot or riding an armored horse. And in both cases, the kings gave away extensive tracts of lands with peasants on them to feed the horse warriors. You may even argue causes were somewhat comparable. In either case, they were linked to a revolution in warfare. Whether the armored knight of medieval Europe or the heavy chariot of the Hittites. You can, however, not claim the two things were linked or connected, because the Hittites had obviously no notion of the European knights 2000 years later, whereas all notions of the Hittites had vanished in the 10th century common era, until they were discovered in the early 20th century. If, on the other hand, you compare European fiefs and feudal oaths of the 11th century to the Russian Druzhina in the same period, there are very good grounds to suspect the two may actually be connected and linked, since, after all, the ruling group of Kievan Rus were the very same Norsemen who also conquered England. Now, turning to connective history, practitioners of almost any branch of science or scholarship commonly like to boast how very ancient the discipline is. Astronomists would like to trace themselves back to Stonehenge, economists to Aristotle, and international relation theorists, as part of political science, at least to Kant, if not to Thucydides. And I might thus claim too that connective world history goes way back to the Middle Ages, when there were actually a lot of works titled World History written. Except that these medieval world histories were written from a theological point of view, in which the meaning of history is that humanity has to atone for its sins by the grace of the loving God until the day of judgment and until the coming of the thousand years realm of Christ. But obviously, since God loves all of humanity, such a history must embrace all of humanity, all over the world, whether that humanity was known in the Middle Ages or not known. While this is a view of history still being taught to aspiring ministers of the faith, it is not one you commonly teach in history classes, perhaps Mormon Brigham Young University excepted. A secular way of writing world history, as a connective, linked narrative, had in a way to wait the 20th century. There are two reasons for that, and they merit a short digression. Historians, the class of social scientists, as they are, for instance, in Africa and many South American universities, or as scholars of literature and arts, as they are in Europe and the USA, have a profound inferiority complex towards natural scientists, and towards physicists in particular, because physicists make all those startling and exciting discoveries. Pictures of the moon of Jupiter, super black holes in the center of the galaxy. Whereas historians often in their own estimation too, just keep poring over the same tired old documents, time and time over again. And they're always rehearsing the very same old discussions, time and time over again. An extreme example of this inferiority complex of historians might be the work of Hayden White, who argues that over the past 2 centuries there has been no real progress in history whatsoever, and that what kind of history is being written entirely depends on what poetical or rhetoric device the author of a history employed, as opposed, of course, to those hard sciences. Well, with all these discoveries of the moon of Jupiter, other super black holes in the center of the galaxy, there has been steady progress. A progress which makes any view of 30, nay 20 years ago, obsolete. What Hayden White ignores is that since the 18th century, there has been substantial progress in history as well. In the 19th century, the great publishing projects, such as the 360 volumes of the Monumenta Germanica Historia, in which all medieval sources have been painstakingly edited and published. And there has been further progress in the 20th century. That progress has more than doubled the span of time covered by history, and it has immeasurably increased the space covered by history. For example, the Sumerian language was really only deciphered in the early 20th century. This meant that some 1,000 years were added to the historic records, whereas Hittite was deciphered by Czech linguist Bedi Grosny while serving in the Austrian-Hungarian army in 1915. This too meant that an entirely new epoch of history was added, an epoch which had been forgotten for the last 2,000 years, except for a single obscure passage in the Bible. These were, clearly, major discoveries, on a par with the theory of relativity, or indeed even those moons of Jupiter, except that historians generally do not herald them very much. All this really meant that world history could not really be written until the 1920s, since historians had so far ignored more than half of human history, the entire period from 5000 to roughly 1000 before Common Era. This process, furthermore, is still ongoing, as even now many cuneiform tablets and inscriptions are still awaiting to be deciphered. To this, moreover, and second, should be added an enlargement in space. An enlargement in space that has gone even more unheralded, and is yet as important. The most dramatic example of this is African history, that as a discipline barely existed before the 1950s, barring some more or less amateur historians or ethnologists as Leo Fabanius or Camille de la Fosse, who had no training as ethnologists or historians whatsoever. One of the more irritating features of Arnold Toynbee's great work back in the 1930s, and I shall have a lot more to say about Arnold Toynbee in a moment, is that he dismissed all of Africa as uninteresting, as it had no known civilization. I must, however, defend Toynbee, because when he was writing, very little was known about Africa. So, and here's the point of this aggression, global history could really not be written before 1900, because most of human history was back in 1900 an almost complete blank. Whereas, even in relatively well-tilled fields back in 1900, such as the early Middle Ages with all the published documents, there has still been a great deal of progress since, because of new work in archaeology. In other words, historians are often simply too modest about their own accomplishment. There has been an exponential increase in many fields, an increase which is any bit as impressive as that achieved by natural sciences, and historians should really not put themselves down in Hayden White's way as engaging in a rather unimpressive form of literature. Yet this means that only in the last 100 years do European historians have really some idea of what was happening beyond Europe, and can thus seriously start to study all of humanity. There have been 3 pioneers in the field of linked world history, and, no different than often happened with pioneers, modern cosmology, for example, was first pioneered by Giordano Bruno in the early 17th century. But which modern cosmologist has ever heard of or cares about Bruno? These pioneers are either forgotten or unread nowadays. One was a dilettante historian, and in a religious context he could better be called a prophet. However, he shunned all religion. Oswald Spengler. One was a professional historian, though in modern terms he would probably have been rated a political scientist, Arnold Toynbee. And one was a sociologist, who in his later life, however, gravitated towards becoming a prophet, Pitirim Sorokin. Now, during his lifetime already, nobody exactly understood what Oswald Spengler wanted to say, and maybe not even Spengler himself understood. For just like prophets commonly do, most of his work consists of shadowy allusions to woes and dooms that were to come very soon. But he did not care to specify what woes and dooms. However, Spengler made one very important point, and that merits continued consideration. And he made a very major theoretical advance as well. The major point he made, much clearer than ever any writer before him did, was that since the world had now become a global system, it was dominated by the West, for although the word only gained currency during the Cold War, it was Spengler who invented it, it was the duty of the West to study other cultures or civilizations on their own term. And that is actually exactly the point of this course. And Spengler furthermore argued that the West should not automatically assume that since civilizations were momentarily subdued by the West, they were therefore inferior. Another major point that foreshadows the culture wars. And he made a very major theoretic advance, nowadays called cultural relativism. That means that each culture or civilization, looked upon in its own terms, considers itself vastly superior to all others, and there is no point outside of a culture or a civilization to decide which culture or civilization is best. Cultural relativism is a central tenet of anthropology, but since historians often tend to ignore what it means, it may be a repetition and even elaboration. The nicest illustration of cultural relativism I've seen for decades, as well as a good illustration of Herder's idea that culture depends on and is adapted to its environment, was a recent program screened by National Geographic Channel that was called Survive the Tribe. Now, the presenter of that program, who is nota bene rated a survival specialist in the United States, goes to meet what viewers might call primitive tribes, somewhere in an African desert, in an Arctic wasteland, or on the Mongolian steppes. So there he comes, with all his accoutrements of the most advanced civilization. He is, after all, accompanied by a film crew, which have set up instant satellite connections, they have the most advanced cameras, iPhones, what have you, anything most viewers, and indeed your average economists, might quote to show that we have far advanced beyond the state of the Kazakh or the sun. And he then has to do what the tribe does every day, only using, mind you, what the tribe had available, and not something he is brought in by airplane. So, for example, He has to run long distances to outrun Cain. He has to catch a furious pig by jumping into a pit in which trashmen have catched it, or he has to go shooting animals with a bow made of what grows locally, and not with some high-tech bow, which is of no use for the tribe, as they can only use local materials, and so such a high-tech bow will be broken in a few days. And he utterly fails in all that. In fact, since any child does far better than he does, he's rated a child by the men, and commonly even by the women. And the whole tribe, though they're frank much too polite to say it, clearly has a mixture of pity and contempt for him. The tribesmen, then, have good reason to consider themselves vastly superior to Westerners. And in their own terms, they are superior. For any Westerner, cut off from his ties with the outside world, would clearly immediately perish in an environment in which they prosper. Who has the superior civilization? Now, Spengler's point that every civilization should be approached on its own terms, and that it was the duty of the West to not automatically assume its own culture was superior to that of all the others, was reiterated and expanded upon by Arnold Toynbee. Like Spengler, Toynbee was a celebrity in his time, and in the 50s he acted as a kind of media guru, and was almost heralded a prophet too, and this very reluctantly on Toynbee's part, who actually detested all that publicity. And like so many other instant celebrities, Toynbee has been completely forgotten. And yet Toynbee is no doubt the founder of modern linked world history. And this not only due to his main thesis, which remains not only plausible, but is in my view a warning to the modern West. And that was that vigorous and technological successful civilizations tend to evolve an assertive and creative elite. An elite which then, because of its technological lead, sets out on a spree of conquest, while at the same time creating a disenfranchised and discontented proletariat, in the literal sense of people who own nothing but their children. Such conquests, by themselves, tend not to be that difficult, so that the elite conquers ever more land. But because it then has to guard against both the external proletariat in the conquered territories and against its own population, which makes seek recourse in dreams of salvation, whether that be religious, such as early Christianity, or secular, such as Marxism, the elite tends to evolve into an increasingly militarized and stiflingly conformist group, as they have to live under strict discipline, fearing all their enemies, or their potential enemies. This stifles any new cultural or technological innovation in the conqueror civilization, and it indeed increasingly begins to resemble conquered people, as it has to be constantly on guard against both its own population and those of the conquered lands. These vital civilizations, therefore, then gradually tend to break down as they lose their previous technological and cultural lead over the conquered people by the very conformity they have to impose upon themselves. And so they either collapse from within, or they are overrun by the people they had themselves subdued. Toynbee, by training a classical historian, argued this was what happened to the classic Greeks in Hellenistic times, to the Romans, and was what might well befall England or the USA, were they not to refrain from choosing a very similar easy way of conquest. An easy way of conquest that they had chosen in the 19th and 20th century. And who can deny there might be something to Toynbee's thesis? However, above all, Toynbee is the founder of linked world history, as he dramatically expanded the field of history in two ways. First of all, he was the first to expand the field of history from the, as it were, acknowledged civilizations, those of the Nile Valley, the Euphrates, Europe, China, India, maybe Indonesia, to include, for example, those of the Americas. And he dramatically increased the number of civilizations to 25, from the best 12 that had been discerned so far, including the fascinating concept of aborted or stilted civilizations. Civilizations which did not fully mature, as they were overrun by more powerful neighbors, or the other way around, because their elites became prematurely so obsessed with running other people's affairs that their civilization never quite came to maturity or fruition, as Toynbee said, happened, for example, to the 10th and 11th century Viking civilization. There was, however, also a major weakness in Toynbee's theory, and that was that he conceived civilizations as more or less evolving in isolation from one another. And it is precisely from this point that modern linked world history takes off. In linked world history, Toynbee's view is, as it were, put upside down. While in Toynbee's view, the central factor in the evolution of civilization is the development of culture within a civilization, it is here considered to be not so much internal developments in civilizations, as rather developments in civilizations are caused by the contact they have with outsiders. The idea is that one group of people invent something useful, whether that be horseback riding, arrow melting, or industrial societies. Outsiders, because it gives them some military or economic advantages, like them, and they lure them too. As they, however, live in a different environment, they change these innovations somewhat, and they improve upon it. This gives them, in turn, an advantage over the first group, who adopt then the improved version of their own idea. They can change it somewhat, and so the cycle goes on and on. Obviously, this works best for technological history, but it can well be applied to the history of ideas, including religious ideas. The task for linked world history, then, becomes to study the links between the whole, rather than separate parts of the world. Whether that concerns the transmission of diseases, of cultivated plants, and so on, that is so dear to big history, or the formation of an interlinked diplomatic and economic system, which is so dear to international history. However, though I sympathize with linked world history, and indeed these lectures are an attempt at creating a linked world history, there are two major problems with linked world history. And for these two reasons, I feel linked world history is increasingly being replaced by international history. First of all, there is a major problem with the sources, and for that matter, even with the literature. Characteristically, sources namely tend to be thickest on both core areas and core ideas of civilizations, whereas the transmission of ideas and of technologies typically occur at the fringes of civilizations. We have, for example, loads of information on gunpowder once it begins to be used in European battlefields, because only then chronicles, typically only interested in courts and monasteries, begin to mention gunpowder. But though we are sure this technology was transferred from China to Europe, how this was exactly done, on this issue we have no information whatsoever, as this probably happened by itinerant merchants, small people in whom bishops, kings or abbots were not interested. This is even a problem for the 20th century, and here it is due to the nature of the historical profession itself. Historians, after all, can learn only so many languages, and when they've learned them, they spend decades studying one country, or commonly even only one area in one country. So they will violently resist any amateur outsider that tries to intrude in their field. And they will typically tend to emphasize internal motives or causes rather than external. If, after all, for example, you've spent years reading through government files of the government of Ghana, and have spent years precisely how ministers such or such related to the president, for which you have been going through his personal correspondence that you have traced in a small village, as the first researcher to ever do so, you will likely resist any attempt of some outsider to tell you all that did not matter, and the whole policy of Ghana was determined by the World Bank in Washington anyway. So, for instance, the history of decolonization, and that's very clearly a linked topic, of the past 20 years, as the historians, I mean, in their respective national archives, has completely splintered. There's now no longer a decolonization. There is a British, a Dutch, a Belgian, a French decolonization instead. All are purely determined by the internal politics of the countries. Second, there is a very major problem in ascertaining how strong links exactly have to be if you want to say that things are linked. Thus, to stay with my example, historians of decolonization will no doubt admit that governments in the Netherlands, in Britain, in France, in Belgium were well aware of what was happening elsewhere. But they will next say that for the actual determination of policy, this was not important. Because while governments were well aware of the international context, to make an actual decision, they had to count on majorities in the national parliament, with party politics, or indeed, to how ministers in the cabinet related to other ministers. And if you have to go by the personal papers of ministers, the smell of the breath of a fellow minister is a very major factor in deciding national security policy. They will, in other words, argue that while there were links, these links were in the final instance not strong enough to determine the policy making. And therefore, all we can do is on the one hand to write at the very best what they call comparative history of decolonization, which commonly means that the history of various countries is addressed by the specialist. These various essays are then thrown together in a bundle, and the editor adds a few introductory phrases, in which he commonly stresses that things are not comparable at all. And on the other hand, one can write an international history of decolonization, studying, for example, the policy of the United Nations on that issue. All these various national histories are not linked. In other words, the nature of the profession itself encourages fissiparious tendencies in writing history, and this makes attempts to link it very difficult from the very outset, because you're very likely to anger the specialist on a country with the general thesis that it is linked to another country. Having said all this, how do we go about in this course on world history? There are five interlinked themes in this course. First, there is the rise of the capitalist world system, best known through the works of Immanuel Wallerstein. world system refers to an interregional and transnational division of labor that divides the world into core countries, semi-periphery countries, and periphery countries. Core countries focus on high skills, capital-intensive production, while the rest of the world focuses on low-skill, labor-intensive production and on the extraction of raw materials. All this constantly reinforces the dominance of core countries. Parallel to this rise of the capitalist world economy, and indeed indispensable and closely linked to it, there was the formation of a strong and increasingly intrusive and interventionist state, a state that penetrated ever deeper into the life of its subjects. On the international level, however, all these states were part of at least a nominal hierarchy of equal and independent states, and all these states jealously guarded their sovereignty, that is, that every state determines the law within its own boundary and is the absolute ruler within its boundary, in which other states have no rights to intervene. That is the system international historians call the Westphalian system. However, it is now the only system. Inwardly, states may still differ. Outwardly, they almost have and respect the same form. And while the economic system is thus becoming more global, the political system becomes ever more fractured. Third, there was an ever-decreasing variety of forms of political organization, ushering in the virtual political monoculture that exists nowadays. Four, and this may make the point clear, while people obviously greatly vary in languages, in environments, and in culture, isn't it a bit odd? They are nowadays politically all arranged in the precisely same way, that they all have parliaments, political parties, elections, and so on. And this irrespective whether they are located in the Pacific, the Himalaya, in Central Asia, in Central Africa, or in the Pampas. Fourth, there was a steady expansion of hierarchic agricultural societies to the detriment of hunter-gatherers, chiefdoms, and nomadic societies. The economic organization of humanity became thus increasingly a similar monoculture of people tilling the land and recognizing some people as their social inferiors, others as their superiors. And finally, the world has also religiously become ever more of a monoculture, as the overwhelming majority of its inhabitants now believe in a book religion that is mediated by religious specialists. And moreover, as the religions, but the monotheisms in particular, have become ever more intolerant towards defiant or folk forms of their own religion.